At this time, I'd like to introduce tonight's speaker. Please join me now in extending a warm welcome to Dennis.
For those of my home group who don't recognize me dressed up, I'm Dennis McBride. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is February 23rd, 1986. I have a home group, which is a good bunch of them here. I have a sponsor who's here, and my grand sponsor's here, so I got to clean up my act a little bit. Tuesday night, Steve was kind enough to ask me to speak tonight, and well, it wasn't quite asked. You know, Steve's very forceful. I think I was voluntold that I was something along the lines of McBride, Friday night, 8 o'clock, 3 B's, be good, be brief, be gone. And I have to, after over 27 years in the Marine Corps and being married to a redhead, I know how to take orders. Well, maybe it didn't happen exactly like that, but it was something close. You know, if I had to put a title on when I speak, it was an inside job. Because it was mainly about feelings. You know, growing up when I was young, I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on the drunkalogue, but just enough to qualify that. Growing up, I was athletic. I played like 3 sports. I was smart. We were in advanced class. I had a very loving family. At the time, I didn't think we had any alcoholics in the family. I found out that was not correct many years later. But there was always something missing. There was always some sort of apart from, less than, a hole in the middle. And, you know, being a jock and, you know, my dad was a principal in another part of the school, the town, you know, I had to be respectable. Not be too rowdy and get in too much trouble, so I didn't drink. Until I got accepted to college my senior year, and we were going to yearbook parties, and, you know, what the hell? You know, what difference does it make? So I said, well, going to college, I better learn how to drink that stuff. So I got 4 cans of the 16-ounce Colt 45s. And never drank it again, by the way. So we're going to the first yearbook party, and so I popped this one of the cap and just chugged it down. Nothing happened. So I popped another one, chugged it down. Still nothing happened. So I go in there, you know, do our thing, go to another party. Okay, 2 more. You know, and about 15 minutes later, pow! And all I remember is stumbling back, going in, at the evening, somebody got us home, and I snuck in the house, tripped, slammed into the refrigerator. It rocks back and forth, bounces against the wall. My mother comes down, your father, blah, 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 blah. I remember getting sick as hell. And the worst thing is they made me go to school the next day. And I remember walking down the hall with my hand on the wall, just staggering along, because I just felt so bad. It was so bad I couldn't wait to do it again. And I was a head lifeguard at our community pool there, and we had older guys there. It was in New Jersey, you had to be 21 to drink, but the older guys were from college, they could get us plenty of alcohol. And I just remember that hole got filled. And within about 12 days, I could drink almost a fifth of the cigarettes. And I later on figured that probably wasn't normal. But that feeling of inadequacy and all that, and you know, the shyness around the girls and the nothing fazed me at that. So I went to college, and that was kind of my introduction. And so I went to college and figured you had to really learn how to drink beer. So in the freshman dorms before we started, we ordered 110 cases of beer. You know, and they said, you guys are too young. And I said, we want 110 cases. We'll be right there. So I learned how to drink Budweiser. Warm, one beer, because I couldn't stand the taste. So that wasn't good enough, so I joined a fraternity. Now this is a good way to get yourself killed if you don't have a strong constitution. But somehow I survived that and was able to graduate. And there's a lot of horror stories involved in that, but very grateful to get out of there alive and with a degree. And I always knew that my dad was in a war, my grandfather was in a war, so I was, and I'm going to go into service. So I wanted to be what I considered one of the best, and so I joined the Marine Corps. Parents didn't know that. So I disappeared one, you know, after the summer after I graduated, I disappeared one afternoon. I went downtown and, you know, saw a couple of recruits. First of all, I went to the first recruiter, and he's talking to me, his eyes light up. Hey, I got a live one here. And he says, you going to college, kid? I said, yes, sir. And he said, get out. Same thing happened to the next recruiter, and he eventually sent me to what they call the officer selection officer up in Newark. But anyway, so I got into the Marine Corps, and eventually, you know, you go to the OCS boot camp, do all that type thing, got commissioned, and that's when it really started to pick up as far as the drinking, because it was, I won't say required, but expected. And I was initially in an infantry regiment in the 1st Marine Brigade in Kaneohe Bay, Hawaii, and the officers club was right across from the BOQ, where I started. And just about everybody in the wing and in the regiment Friday night was at happy hour. And the things that went on, you could not get away with today. I mean, diving off the roof into the pool and officers getting in fights. My boss was a no-neck. He played offensive tackle for Boston College, so he's a big guy. And somebody kept punching, one of the air wingers kept doing this in his chest. You don't belong in here. This is an air wing, you know. So he launched him over two tables. And of course, he forgot he had a glass in his hand, so he sort of cut his throat a little bit. So there's blood everywhere, and nothing happened. In fact, the guy that was doing this got in trouble with the wing for causing a disturbance. But that's how life was back then. In fact, I had family members later on said, you know, it was my wife at that time, and her sister said, you know, you drink an awful lot. And I said, well, of course I do. I'm a Marine. That's what we do. And we did. But who's going to notice this little, you know, 5'8" guy in the back when you got a 6'2" major who's streaking down to the corner and back after parties? I'm just sitting in the back drinking my beer, mugs of scotch, and nobody paid that much attention because I was always hanging around with people that were really, really lit up. One other incident. I'm at that same bar, happy hour, of course. I'm sitting at the bar and somebody had just retired. So they're buying the drinks at the bar. And then we played dice. Ship captain's crew, a bunch of different games with dice. And I'm winning. So I'm winning more scotch. And then there's this one waitress keeps coming by. Boom, puts another free drink up there. Boom, puts another free drink up there. So evening wears on, and I vaguely remember getting kind of dragged back to the BOQ, just up the stairs, and I'm like this, you know, somebody's carrying me up the stairs, and I wake up the next morning just hungover as hell, and I roll over and bang into something. Well, that was that waitress. And that was not the word, that was the XO's fiance. So I kind of laid low a little bit after that. But on the way to the, she's going up to the altar and she leans up, you know, they're going to getting married on the beach, and she leans over and said, it should have been us. I said, oh, run, Denny, run. It's one of many bullets that I dodged along the way. So anyway, I went there, second lieutenant, left for Okinawa, a captain, or selected to be a captain with a master's degree and married. So it was a pretty eventful, and a kid. So it was a pretty eventful tour. So moving on in time, somewhere along that I found out that my grandmother's three brothers, they're all from Philly, all three of them were raging alcoholics. One was a bookie, one was a government guy, had a GS-12 during the Depression. And so he fed basically the entire block back in those days. And I forget what the other guy did, but They're all just raging alcoholics. Later on, I met one when he was living with my grandmother after his health had gone south. And so I got to see it firsthand because my parents, and my dad, you know, they'd have a whiskey sour every 2 months and they'd drink like half of it. And I didn't pay much attention to that. But so in the Marine Corps, I'm coming back to town and I knew where all the cops were. But I was coming back to visit some of the guys that I knew in the neighborhood I played ball with. And all these guys had been thugs. I played CYO basketball afterwards in the summers and stuff, and so Christian Youth Organization anyway. So these guys were, they would steal the altar wine. They were in trouble all the time. So I go back, and now they're like the treasurer and vice president of the Knights of Columbus. they got like 10 kids apiece and stuff. So we're drinking it. We're just, playing cards and drinking and drinking. Just throw the money in the bar because the one guy's the treasurer. We'll settle up later. But I remember, I just bring this up because I don't know if anybody can relate to this. When you drink so much, your eyes can't focus. So, I'm trying to drive home from the Knights of Columbus place, and I know where the cops are, so I go to the back. Well, actually, a lot of them were my high school graduate buddies, so I probably could have gotten away with it anyway, but I'm driving in the back, and I couldn't see out the windshield. So I drove home with the car door open because I could focus on the road. I don't think that's normal either. Younger brother, didn't know he was in that much trouble, but he stayed up in New Jersey. We're down here in Virginia, up by Quantico, and he was an exceptional athlete. He was scouted by the pros in high school. He went to college. He got us into the state finals in high school, and he went to two or three college. He got a full ride to University of Connecticut back then. They were the number one soccer school in the country, and he drank his way out of about three colleges. Anyway, he went driving a trash truck, made a fortune driving a trash truck in New Jersey, and he was drinking. I didn't know it, but he was drinking a lot and doing a lot of cocaine, a lot of other stuff that was going to get him killed. So we did a family intervention, and so we got him into treatment. About 8 days later, our 14-year-old son, I'm coming home from work, and there's cop cars in the driveway with the lights going. Oh. He had broken into a house. He'd been drunk. He'd broken into a house down the street, and he had gone upstairs to steal some guns or something, and if he had turned the top, the cop told us, if he had turned the top of the stairs with a shotgun in his hands, they'd have shot him. But for some reason, he put it down, and they brought him home, and they locked him up, and so we eventually got him into treatment 8 days later. So we're going to doing all this stuff, and they're sending us to Al-Anon and medical aspects of alcoholism and stuff. So I'm going to these Al-Anon meetings, and I just got tired of them talking about me. I remember distinctly, I said, I'm going upstairs with the big boys. So that started, it was just a tremendous relief. By the way, did Steve say 30 minutes or 3 hours I was supposed to spend? Anyway, it was such a relief to be able to do something about it. Alcohol had been such a constant companion for decades, and I've gone through a lot of time and a lot of stories, but I did want to move on. But just knowing that I was doing something about it was almost euphoric. I wasn't well received at the very first AA meeting I went to because they said, are you here for the courts, or are you here to get sober? Keep your mouth shut. No, so I said, okay. And back then we sat in circles, chairs in a big circle, and they said, well, I'm Joe Schwo, I'm Ann, I'm Betty, I'm Bill, and I'm alcoholic. And he came around to me and said, I'm Denny Alcoholic. So I didn't want to be different. It wasn't until a year later I finally sitting there going, God damn, I'm an alcoholic. And so the acknowledging and accepting, I found out very quickly, were a great deal different. So I started, they said do 90. First of all, we had been to counseling. Shocking. My wife was worried that I was drinking too much and had anger issues. Hard to believe, right? So, by the way, I still go to counseling sometimes for anger issues, but not anywhere near as bad as it used to be. So we're there. And so she said, I normally tell people, if they're not sure about their drinking, either I want you for 30 days either drink as much as you want, and my wife won, or don't drink at all. And she said, just see if your life changes. So somehow I was convinced not to drink at all. And I had been sober before. And one time, because I had been a rough patch, and I said, I'm not drinking for 30 days. But I distinctly remember on that 31st day, and when I reflect back on this stuff, it made a lot more sense later on, because a lot of these memory bubbles didn't come back for the longest time. The fact that I was going to AA, and it was just a wonderful feeling. But she said, I'm not going to tell you to, the counselor said, I'm not going to tell you to do 90-90 because you'll do 140. Because I honestly believed anything worth doing is worth doing compulsively. So 3 miles is good, run marathons. You know, so I did all that kind of stuff. So I did. I went to these meetings, and it started getting a lot better. And I kept telling, you know, my first sponsor, I said, you know, I'm having trouble relating to these people. I mean, I've never lost a job. I've never, you know, wrecked a car. I've never been arrested. I still got the same wife she left once, but she came back, so that doesn't count. And so what? He says, you've never had a DUI ever? And I said, no, never. And he leaned over at my, he looked at me and he says, well, how many should you have had? And I could just cringe, because that little incident with the car door open, that was just one of many. In fact, I remember the relief, having been sober for about 2 weeks, going in the gate, Marine Corps base, and not having to worry about lighting up a cigarette or chewing gum or any of that. So that was quite a bit. Now, they say don't do anything major the first year. So of course my higher power at the time decided I needed orders to Okinawa after 2 months. So away I go. And I'm going back to the same BOQ that I went to as a second lieutenant. No, I was a first lieutenant captain that time. And we were so drunk, there'd be typhoons, hurricanes, and you'd be locked down in typhoon condition, one emergency. But the O Club and the package store were just up that hill. So flak jacket, helmet, holding onto the railing, pulling myself up. But I got there, got the booze, got back. When I went back sober, you know, with the whole 60 days under my belt, I was in the same BOQ. Not the same room, but the same set of block buildings there. And I'll tell you what, I refer to that now in some things I've written up about being in a vertical dungeon. I was terrified. I mean, just the depression, the fear, the desolation that I felt. But my higher power sent my my first sponsor there 10 days prior. It took me 3 days to track him down. But once I found him, he got me, took me some meetings, lent me a car. And after that, it was okay. Then it was okay. But I do remember one story about I'm on Okinawa, and I got two good friends of the guy that was running the treatment center at Kauai Hospital. He was a master gunnery sergeant. And, you know, we didn't know about districts and areas and intergroup. We didn't know any of that stuff. We knew we had a central office down in the warehouse district someplace. I think Buck got it started. That's all I remembered about that kind of stuff. But the master guns comes to me and says, hey, Denny, you want to go on a 12-step call? I said, wow, that sounds cool. I've never done one of those. So away we go to the Kauai Hospital, and up in the... Now let me when I was at Quantico before I went over there, the two majors took me up to the TriSard at Bethesda, TriSard, Tri-Service Treatment Center, and there was a colonel up there that had gotten a lot of trouble, and he's in the treatment up there. There's a lot of senior people in this one group. And he said, "No, I got this now. I now know I got the willpower, and I can lick this thing because I'm strong now." And I'm sponsor. I don't think that's right. I don't think that's right. So I go. So fast forward, 6 months later, I'm on this 12-steps call, Okinawa, going up to the treatment up there, and all these people in pajamas. And who's up there? That colonel. In pajamas with a little plastic thing around his arm. I don't know what happened. But I learned then that trying to do this thing on my own was not going to work. So I needed the help. So many, many years later, I didn't, about service and getting in, having sponsees and all that stuff. I hope the preacher's not around, but I had 13 years in when I finally came back to the States again, and at one time, and I joined a men's group up in Springfield, it's a men's group, and they say, "Well, we're going to do birthdays next time," and I said, "Yeah, I got 13 years." He looked at me and said, "You got 13 years? You're bad shit crazy. How can you have 13 years?" And I'll tell you what, I don't think I was in for, I was like 16 years before anybody asked me to sponsor them. And I kind of understand why. But I needed a lot of help. And I got some inside rooms and some outside rooms. And then when I finally got back and decided to, then I was retired back in the area, then we found out, that you have a GSR. I didn't know what that was. If you have enough districts together, you have an intergroup, and then you have districts, and you have areas, and you have, the general services offices and all that stuff. So that was a great feeling, because I always did like to be in service. And one of the things I've really learned is that those people that are truly happiest in life are in the service of others. And I've been grateful for that all along, and I've been able to had the benefit of a lot of different positions over the years. I started a group in the buildings outside of Cooey Hospital, and I was the secretary, treasurer, chair. Got the beginning package from New York and started that meeting. And other ones I picked up because they were failing, and we got those going. And since I've been here, I can't believe it. The only time in my life I've been other than my last duty station where I was the base commander, that was the only place I'd ever been more than 19 months in 27 years. And so being here for as long as we have, I found out about all this stuff. And of course, being a GSR was the best part of it. And if you haven't been one of those, get a little time under your belt, I'd give it a shot. And then you'll learn that there is a big service structure other than just the just making coffee and pulling in chairs. By the way, I do dress up nicely, but when I first came in, they knew they had talent on their hands. They knew that I was going to be special because I got to clean ashtrays. Now, for the newcomers, you didn't realize back then I couldn't see Buck. In a normal meeting, I could not see this three rows away. And if you wanted to breathe, you had to sit by a window or a door. And there were meetings in other places other than churches. We still have a few of those. There's a few clubs around. There's a scout cabin, some place like that. But almost all of them in churches now. And with the change in insurance policies, as I said, no smoking in your building. And that's really cleaned up. For the great benefit of a lot of people, the smoking. So I've had to endure a lot of things, and that younger brother we put in treatment, he died of alcoholism. His body just finally shut down. He just couldn't take it. He did a lot of many other things, and he developed some severe mental problems, but his body just shut down. He couldn't take it. And we just, my son died sober in July. But it was really as a result of all the damage that he had done after 20 years of heavy, heavy drinking and smoking, and he got esophageal cancer, which they say the doctors told him is the only way you get esophageal cancer is either heavy smoking and drinking. So hopefully I dodged that bullet, at least for a while. But I've gotten through those things, and I firmly believe that it's the big things that aren't going to get me. It's the ankle biters. Because they can kind of irritate you. You get those, you get upset, and then you get a little angry, and then you get a resentment, and then you get the technical term is the efforts. But I don't have to do that today. I try to meet with sponsees. I'm a crappy sponsee. I do try to contact Buck and work with him. By the way, don't blame him. He's only had me for about 6 months. So in that time, iron out all the imperfections. So, and there's many. But I'm trying to do better at that, and I've had many, many sponsees that have done very well, and some, like I would speak out at the Navy base, I think that's called Trisard or now too, but the treatment center out on the Navy base. I've spoken there a couple of times, and if you don't know of it, they have to get a sponsor before they can leave. So I've had a number of them ask me, and I never got the first phone call. They just disappeared. So that happens. But there's something that, and I've talked to Buck about this. In fact, I thought I'd started doing something really clever, and then he hands me a book of wisdom in the meetings. Because I have no original thoughts. I just steal whatever somebody smarter than me says at the meetings, or has a better spiritual program, or who's really into service, kind of like Steve, just really works really hard at this program. So I started collecting. And I was going to start the meeting tonight just starting off. Is this guy really an alcoholic? Is he really an alcoholic? Well, I'm the kind of guy that walks into a bar, all you can drink for a dollar. Give me $3 worth. Now, I'm not much, but I'm all I think about. I pride myself, this is mine. There's the only one in four pages that I won't read them all, but that I said, I pride myself in being very flexible. I just hate change. I'm a social drinker. You drinking? Socialize. This is the important one, and I've heard this over and over again over the years. Not every time that I drink did I get in trouble, but damn near every time I was in trouble, I'd been drinking. And one of my favorites, I am terminally unique. These two I heard in our home group, the only way I could stop drinking was if I ran out or I passed out. I can't drink, I'm allergic. I break out in handcuffs. And these, just quickly, reflections on the solution. Change I must or die, I will. You can start your day over anytime you want. And I've used that so many times. Many times on the golf course. But and this is from a 14-year-old girl up, I think it was in Northern Virginia. Expectations or resentments under construction. Man, do I believe that. Humility is not thinking of myself less, not thinking less of myself, but thinking of myself less. This one I've heard from preachers. I've heard it from senior executives and captains in industry. I've heard it in the military. Never miss an opportunity to keep your mouth shut. If nothing changes, nothing changes. And this is one that I've heard recently from Elijah. Victims never recover. And that's something I think a lot of people in our society could learn from as well. An AA meeting is the only place I can go to reminisce with strangers. And Leo said, different doesn't equal wrong.
Would you repeat that one?
I said, different doesn't equal wrong. That's from Leo Ruffin. Try this program for a few months. If it doesn't work, we'll refund your misery. This is one, man, I wish I'd learned this, because I, being a type A, I am such a people pleaser. No longer any of my business what you think of me. Mm-hmm. Only what I think of you. And that's got, you know, this is another one I sort of formulated kind of from what I heard. A wise man plans for tomorrow. It's the fool that lives there. You know, I did this one, I spoke, I don't know, 6-8 months ago, and I was really sick. Wasn't COVID, I had taken all the tests and everything, but I was sick. So I got about a third of the, you know, about 2/3 of the way through, and I just grabbed this stuff and started reading it off. And one of my sponsees comes up to me and says, I got to speak in North Carolina. Give me that list. Give me that list. You know, and this is Father Martin. Be on guard for unguarded moments. And from Elijah again, he's a member of our home group. Buck's given me a number of these too. If I don't change, my sobriety date will. Be kind to the newcomer. They may be your next sponsor.
Yeah.
and I'll end on this. Beware of the illusion of control. I'm very grateful to be a part of AA today. I've met friends that I will never forget. I have people that can carry me through the worst of the times and sometimes even keep me calmed down through the best of times. Because I drank when I was extremely excited, I got a promotion or I got a medal. Or I drank because I had been crushed emotionally or I was just sad. And I drank because it was Tuesday. So, it's great to be here again. I've spoken at this group at different times over the years. I've been told two other times. So either I did pretty well or you have a very short memory. And with that, I think I'll end it up. Thanks so much for asking me to speak.
Dennis, thank you for your